All right. Welcome to the Poetry Show. We broadcast here on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock in the morning. And my good friend and longtime host at this project, Janet Harrison, is here with us. And our guest today is Tom Donlan, who has just published a fabulous book of poetry and a local star here in the poetry circles of Jefferson County. A real star. And so I want to welcome them both and hand it over to Janet here to get us started. Janet.
Okay. Well, Tom Donlan lives with his wife and children in Shenandoah Junction, West Virginia. He earned an MFA in poetry from American University in Washington, D.C. before moving to West Virginia in 1986. He was awarded a chapbook, Peregrine, in 2016 by the Franciscan University of Steubenville, Ohio. He's received Pushcart Pride nominations and a fellowship from the West Virginia Community Commission of the Arts. He's also the Region 10 representative for the West Virginia Writers Association and a fine poet, longtime host of Bookend Poets. And Tom, do you want to add anything before you start with your introducing your first poem?
Good morning. Thank you, John and Janet. And of course, Janet, you're a great poet too. Wonderful to be with you on the show here. I've enjoyed your work and known you for a long time.
Yes, we have.
And I've been on this show with John many years ago. I can't remember what year it was, but it's great to be friends with both of you.
Well, welcome. Do you want to say anything before you start reading your first poem?
Well, the book took decades to get published, and part of it is because my wife and I have six children, so I couldn't really get into the poetry world as much as I had hoped to. I mean, I taught at Shepherd as an adjunct for a few years, but I had to get corporate jobs to make money to raise six children. So it took years and years to get the collection published, but it's finally out. It's 127 poems, and it covers, I mean, Beth and I will have 40 years of marriage in August, and our six children are all raised. But, the poems are about our raising six kids, our marriage, and our spiritual journeys through life.
And the book is called Apart, I Am Together, which is a very interesting paradox of the title.
Right. Yeah, I think my wife said we should write a book about what we've experienced together as raising six kids.
Do you ever have the challenge that some of the kids have to help you raise the other kids? Don't the older ones have to help raise the younger ones in a six children household? I was just wondering about how the division of labor went.
Well, we still have four daughters locally here and a granddaughter. The two sons are gone and married and have kids. But everybody needs to help out. I come from a huge Boston Irish Catholic background, lots of kids. I thought that was normal, having a big family.
Well, it's your normal. I mean, that's for sure. So,
right.
So you said that it's family inspired poetry. So, and by that you mean just the, there's a drama every day, right, of some sort. I'm interested. What is it that kicks it off for you? Is it some kind of event that says, oh, you know, that could be a poem. That could be, you know, I see something there.
I used to drive down to Ashburn, Virginia for many years for Verizon. And driving down there, I would think of poetry ideas and stuff and start to write them in my head. And a lot of family events, raising children, you know, there's a lot of my poems that are about kids. In fact, my father was a just a genius portrait painter. And I wanted to be an artist like him, but I wasn't that good. So I became a writer. But as I've realized over the years, I've finally realized that I have written poems about all my kids, and they are portraits in words.
Oh, okay. All right. Excellent.
The genesis of this first poem wasn't so much family as it was, I think, a news article.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you, Janet.
I said the genesis of this first poem wasn't so much family, I think, but it seems to be a news article for Skull.
Okay, well, we live in right behind Driswood Elementary School. And when that was being built, that's where I got the information for that poem, Skull. Shall I read that poem?
Yes, please.
Please do, yeah.
Okay. Skull. Jawless, it rolled from an earth pile after rain at the elementary school construction site. Workers laying pipe thought it was a rock. Work stopped. Police wrapped the area with tape. The grated ground covers sinew and bone, synapse and cell. An African-American girl, pre-Civil War, lost her lowest denominator. Even when my lab died, I curled her paws in rest before I shoveled earth on her. The tape is gone. Sewer pipe is in. Grass grows. Skeletal frames of scaffolding aid masons who lay blocks for walls. Soon a curving road will sing with busloads of children packed for school. She seeks her parts, breastbone, widening pelvis, and someone to tell what left her there alone and apart. You will hear, young one, bursts of laughter, children on swings, their ears open to hear a field that speaks.
Wow.
I think that, yeah, the apparently the skull was sent to the Smithsonian, and they determined that it was a pre-Civil War African-American girl skull. But yeah, I didn't realize until we moved here how drenched we are in Civil War stuff here.
Yes.
And in fact, I just finished a book by Doug Perks, who's a historian in Charlestown. It's called The Civil War Years in Jefferson County, Virginia.
Sure.
And it's just everywhere we walk around here, there's just Civil War stuff.
I was listening yesterday to a memoir of a guy who was traveling into Samarkand, and he was describing that the city had been razed four times in its history, and in the last big time was Tamerlane, who came through and killed everybody in the town and piled their skulls in little mounds all over the city, mainly as a warning to the next town that they should welcome, you know, the conqueror with gifts rather than resistance. And but that it was a habit of piling skulls up. And so I remember the guy was saying that a little bit like you just described, that, you know, you're walking over a history in the town, right in Samarkand. I think it's in Uzbekistan now. And this history of tragedy, you know, right beneath your feet, you know, and going back all the way to whenever the Mongols first came in there, what, 1200, something like that. And that's true. You around here, you're always conscious of your walking on the past. I think that's. It touches
me. I think
me.
The most poignant line in the poem is in someone to tell her, so tell her what left her there alone in the park. I read that and I just thought that just hit my heart immediately, Tom.
Yeah. Yeah, my wife really liked that. She, in fact, my wife helped me with the editing. My wife helped me with the editing.
I remember you talked about your wife helping you with the editing way back when you were just submitting the trying to figure out which poems to include. I remember you that was a tough one. You had to hand that job to her. You couldn't drop one of them yourself.
That was right, when he was editing Peregrine.
Yeah, the Peregrine. I had submitted a 100-page manuscript to a book contest at the Franciscan University, and I was a finalist. I didn't get the full book. I got a chapbook, which meant about 100 pages to 33, and I couldn't do it, so my wife did it.
Well, you know, it sometimes takes an external force to settle things down. So the skull was just a detail there. Was there a body attached to the skull?
I don't think so. Again, people ask me about details, and I said, well, this is a poem. You know, this is not historical stuff, but...
I mean,
I should probably follow up on that, find out.
I mean, a skull with no body, sort of. That's what made me think of the Samarkand story a little bit, you know. But anyway, wow. There's no. I didn't hear any rhymes about in the poem. I wasn't looking at it. What do you have an attitude? Do you have a feeling about poems that rhyme versus those that don't? Does that have a? You ever get tempted to make it rhyme or intentionally? I don't want it to rhyme. Kind of a challenge.
Well, again, when I was, I could write, but when I got my graduate degree in poetry, I wanted to do poetry because I didn't really know how to write poetry, including the forms, the traditional forms. Sonnets, villanelles, sestinas, etc., which are all rhyme and meter, specific organizations per each type of poem, you know, definitely rhyme. And so I really enjoyed learning how to write those. And sometimes I write open form or free verse, which you've just heard, that skull poem is four stanzas of four lines. And it doesn't have the rhyme and meter thing. But what I learned in graduate school is that poetry does not have to have rhyme. You can make it. I mean, I miss that today because I don't hear the music of poetry a lot. And but if it's concise, powerful, and it doesn't just tell you everything, it shows you something rather than telling you everything. That's poetry. That's what I learned.
Right.
Well, so I have a mix of both.
The images are very powerful in the skull, and they speak for themselves. I think that can certainly carry the force of a poem, just as well as a rhyme. But I just want you know, so you're right. Sometimes when poems rhyme, you know, or they're closer to song, for example, a little bit, you know. And we've had, you know, like a modern culture, I think mostly due to the electronics and everything that's available, we have a mixing of poetry and song that was probably not as strong as it used to be, or as stronger than it used to be. You know, I mean, like, Bob Dylan got the Nobel Prize for Literature. Okay, so people's perspectives on what, and I listen. Janet reads me sometimes the poetry of Joy Harjo, right, a Native American writer, and she's a jazz artist, and she mixes jazz with her. A song with poetry a lot. So I noticed that. In song, for example, rhyme's almost mandatory, isn't it? Almost. There's probably some exceptions, but anyway, just...
Well, that's what I hear when I hear songs. I hear rhyme.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, so...
We'll come to a rhyming poem and a poem in form at the end.
All right, well, lead us on, Janet.
Okay. This next poem is one of his family poems. It's one of my favorites from the book. It's called Ballet Lesson, and it's it's one of those poems where it takes a moment and then launches from that moment and into something that winds up being deeper and wider.
Yeah, my mentor at American University's Master's in Poetry was Henry Taylor, famous poet. He lived in Virginia. He called me a family poet. And obviously because I've got all sorts of stuff about my family. As I said, portraits of my kids and words. Here's one about one of my twin daughters, Lily. It's called Ballet Lesson. Lily writhed, her face contorted from catching her finger in the car door. She is six, too young to know such hurt. She grips her hand. In her twisted face, I see the pain of Dido, of Trojan women holding their fallen men, their dying sons. I kiss her hand, no cut, no blood. She wipes her eyes, forgets her grief. As we drive to class, she points out daffodils, dogwood, redbud, forsythia that bloom along this mountain road. Her pink-clad body and blonde hair bounce on the car seat. We follow the winding road to town, not looking too far ahead nor behind, but welcoming this warm, clear day. I pray she will transform the pain of practice, learn the plié, glissade, arabesque, to greet her life on point, to pirouette, to read and embrace in people's faces the centuries of grief, the yearnings, and yes, my little flower, to bloom.
That's very nice.
So early on in the poem, you make the move from this little child that's got her finger caught in the door to universal grief by invoke Dido and the Trojan women.
Right.
And then you back to her. But at the end, again, it expands, you know, all the wishes that a parent has for a child. And especially, I thought it was very important when you say to read and embrace in people's faces the centuries of grief, the yearnings. I thought that was a very interesting move there for her not to move from her own grief as she grows up to be able to recognize other people's grief in their faces and see it. As well as, yes, to blossom.
Yeah. In fact, it is a reality. She is very compassionate now as an adult.
Well, sometimes you get what you wish for.
Yeah.
Well, is she more compassionate than other children? I mean, are the other children less compassionate?
Well, she has a drive toward helping. Like, she works right. with kids a lot, helps kids. Yeah, I guess you recognize in your children stuff.
Well, but also you recognize your own aspirations, right, for her.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when you're thinking about what she might gain from dance and from, or how it might represent your own aspirations.
She's actually a very good artist.
I'm not surprised.
Right. Yeah.
Skip the generation.
Right.
The other lovely moment in the poem is when you actually list the flowers which really locate you in Virginia, I think. Daffodils, dogwood, redbud, forsythia. You know, the specific names and the music of the names, I think, in the middle of the poem really helps the poem a lot.
Well, that's another thing. I grew up in a suburb of Washington, D.C., Fairfax, Virginia. And when we moved to West Virginia in the Blue Ridge in 86, I'd never seen nature like that. So a lot of my poems just are filled with the natural environment of the Shenandoah Valley. And this is West Virginia background stuff here. Used to be Virginia in the Civil War.
Well, before the Civil War, yeah. was 62. That's when the separation took place.
We should know that, John. We don't.
Well, 63, I think there was the first time they voted to secede.
Was it 63?
But the western counties did not. It was just the eastern panhandle, really. And it took years, even after the Civil War, I think, before they finally had it officially done.
Oh, yeah.
Where Jefferson County was part of West Virginia.
There was some controversy, right, about the fact that the federal troops got to vote. there's bound to be controversy, you know, but.
Yeah, there were lots of issues there. And
right.
I mean, if I can diverge here, I grew up down there near also Manassas, the Civil War place. But working with some of my kids on their homework papers living here, I did a paper with one of my sons about the Harper's Ferry raid, John Brown.
Right.
And I didn't know it until I was working on that. I didn't know who arrested him. It was Robert E. Lee who arrested John Brown.
I know. Right. So right before he went the other way.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we have, I mean, I for example, here in Bolivar, I live in Bolivar, actually, you know, we had a group. There's a street about six blocks from me called Mudford's, and it's right in the little project down below Old Furnace Road, right near where I live. And the Mudfords were kids that lived on top of the hill in Bolivar rather than downtown in Harper's Ferry, which was a more itinerant workforce down there. The permanent federal employees lived on top of the hill. And but they got run out when Stonewall took the town. But they were famous. They were called Mudfords because they were the kids on the top of the hill would have mud ball battles with the kids down in Harper's Ferry. And the ones on the top of the hill were considered, you know, fine throwers of mud balls, you know, very accurate, et cetera. And so they got that name, the Mudfords. But when Stonewall came, they disappeared. They were sent to the wind. But we have a street still named after them. Anyway, but I think that the historical poems, you can almost not be historical if you're living here. Going back to your first point, you know, there's so much history beneath your feet.
Yeah, I mean, I walk around here and I just feel like I'm walking on history.
Of course, you have to have a little education in history. How are the you're doing a lot of substitute teaching. Are there a lot of history classes left in the schools? Are we doing history? Or that must be very controversial at the moment, right? Am I wrong?
There's not a whole lot of chaos in the Jefferson County schools that I've known or realized.
Right.
I know there's a lot of political stuff going on in other places, but I haven't seen that so much here.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. Anyway, go ahead. So what's the next poem you got there, Janet?
Why I like the Villanelle. And you had talked about rhyme and poems. The Villanelle is a very strict and demanding form. I'll have him read the poem first, and then I'll explain the form. We can talk a little bit about why the choices a poet might make to write in form or not write in form. But this is why I like the Villanelle. And it's dedicated to somebody we know.
To me. I remember I asked Tom about it. I remember I said, how do you do that? And he said, I'll show you. Something like that way back, yeah.
Well, again, I like the form, and especially if something in my mind starts to sound like music or form or something, then I'll pursue that. So this is why I wrote the Villanelle. It's called Why I Like the Villanelle, and it's for John Case. This rustic country song, deep as a well, thrives despite the claims that rhyme is dead, for beating hearts can never say farewell. Yes, repeated lines are hard to sell, but artfully done can rise like a loaf of bread. This rustic country song, deep as a well. One can hear the ocean in a shell and feel the waves above an oyster bed, or beating hearts can never say farewell. It's fair to say it's tough to write them well, but souls need rhythmic music to keep them fed. This rustic country song, deep as a well. You know it works if you feel inside a gazelle that leaps, your hair just standing on your head, for beating hearts can never say farewell. They're wrong who say they hear a funeral bell. They're drawn to it with a sing-songy dread. This rustic country song, deep as a well, for beating hearts can never say farewell.
No, I just love it. It's just great, man. I just love it. It's just like, it's just as a surprise, practically every line. That was great. Just beautiful, my friend.
The lines are very strict. The rhymes are very strict. You have repeating lines in your first stanza, the first line of the first stanza, and the third line of the first stanza are your repeating lines. And those lines have to be very strong because you're going to hear them again and again and again.
Right.
So that's really, so I love this rustic country song, deep as a well. Though I don't think of Villanelle's as a rustic song, but I don't think of it as rustic. I think it was more cosmopolitan and you know, in salons in France is how I imagine a Villanelle.
Right. You mean like a performance? As there's a, you get a sense of performance in it, and meant to be read aloud actually too, because you. So.
Well, that's another point I forgot to mention is poetry needs to be heard, and that's why they have this traditional rhyme and meter and all that stuff. It's musical, but yeah, you need to hear it.
Is it also true, I mean, if we think, for example, Carol and I have been just binging on these historical lectures on Amazon, great courses, some of which are really good, some of which are a little bit hacky, but a lot of them are just brilliant, and they're comprehensive, too. And so, but you get the sense of a lot of cultures that had a very... that had a lot of culture, but before they had a very widespread or writing system, okay? And so that, like, for example, the Homeric poems and things like that had to have been passed down partly as, like, from memory, right? From social memory of people singing it or reading it or saying it. And the rhymes would have been an important part of... at least in whatever language it was composed, of maintaining it, meaning how does it go down from one generation to another. I think about, for example, the number of versions of certain types of blues songs, okay, that, you know, you hear today that were, you look at the way that Lightnin' Hopkins did it 50 years ago, okay, and then you look at it today, and it's the same tune, you know, the words keep added on, and the language keeps evolving, you know. But nonetheless, there's something there that was there at the beginning, you know, 50, 100 years before, and it's mostly passed on as an oral tradition, even still, right? I've seen blues singers get up and basically extemporize, right? You know, they'll start, you know, punching out lyrics just as they sing them that they had never sung before. So I think that musicality probably has a long base in oral tradition, right? It would seem to me.
I agree.
But I love that form. It's hard to write, though, right? I mean, I tried one after you did one. I remember I tried 3 or 4 times to get one to work, and maybe I should have tried harder. I don't know. It seemed very hard to do.
Well, again, we had to write these in graduate school. I had to learn them. Yeah, in fact, in this collection, the part I am together, I think I've got about 6 villanelles.
Oh, you got that many? Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, you must have. So there are, but are they fun to write? I mean, do you have a good time writing them compared to some other kind of poem, or are you kind of agnostic about it?
Well, it's definitely more of a challenge to compose something that has strict guidelines. You know, as Janet said, the 2 lines from the first stanza, or tercet, I guess you call it. The villanelle is 19 lines. It's got 5 3-line stanzas and then a 4-line stanza. And there's a certain line, as she mentioned, the first and third lines. Those are repeated in a certain order. So, yeah, it's difficult. But if you get it right, it's cool.
Yeah, it sure is. It really is. Oh, well. Janet, where are we at?
I had some questions about when you make a decision. You said you just, when it starts sounding musical, you try and continue it. Is that how you make a decision to try and do something in form?
Yeah, if it seems to have a form structure, then I'll pursue that. But yeah, I have a lot of open form or free verse poems in my collection too.
Well, you never ignore music, even in free verse. You have to pay attention to the sound of it and the compression. One of my instructors used to refer to that as the pounds per square inch, that poetry has more pounds per square inch than prose. It's very compressed. And
yeah. Well, that's what I learned in graduate school, and I didn't understand why can't we continue the rhyme and meter stuff. Why do we do open form and free verse? And I realized that, as you said, the pounds and the power and conciseness of modern poetry works. It hits you hard if it's well done. It doesn't have to have the rhyme.
No, I think of Jane Kenyon, probably one of my most favorite poets, and I don't think she rarely rhymes, but it's very, very powerful. So to me.
Yep.
Hey, Janet, we're at our 30-minute point. Do we want to do one more, or do we want to wind up? What's your plan? You're muted. Yeah, you're still muted. Well, Janet, somehow she got muted. Let me see here.
Am I unmuted now?
Yes, now you are. Okay.
Okay. Tom, do you want to just read Texting with a Teen and not discuss it to close the show out? I can't hear.
You're muted too, Tom.
Okay, this is another child poem, Texting with a Teen, or Dylan. It has an epigraph at the beginning. F-U means to erase, to take back, to make into nothing. That's a F-U is a word from a poem by Judy Halevsky. The poem is How to Find a Man Up to the Task. So I heard her reading, and that inspired this poem. I told the poet after her reading, now I know what my son means when he texts F-U to me. It's tough to follow the shortcut language of teens. I'm glad to have discovered in Japanese symbols how to relate to my son. Take last week when I texted him to mow the lawn. His response, WTF, made me think he was suggesting a day, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday. I responded, today. He said, OMG. He texted he was playing Xbox. Years ago, I lost my first son to real-time online war games. We'd had a few years of chess, but my level of commitment waned when we moved to handheld controllers. I asked son number two when he would be done on Xbox. IDK, he said. Mow before dark, I said. He texted whatever, and probably did it without looking at the keys on his cell phone. My sons play war games together across the world. The first one, a sailor, is in Tokyo on a ship. Son two is in our basement in West Virginia. They use headphones to converse while they massacre each other's armies in an internet war game in Xbox. IDK, maybe I need to loosen up. As a kid, I'd stand up plastic soldiers and shoot them down with rubber bands. The thrill was there, but not the technology. No, I think it's too late to join that fight. Chess, anyone?
That's great, man.
Right, I love the ending. There's one thing we didn't talk about, your poems, but you always had your poems very strongly, Tom.
Yeah. Well, lots of years here of writing.
Well, this is beautiful. It's been beautiful. I want to thank you so much, Tom, for joining us here. And I hope we can get some more local poets on and do this, Janet. This has been wonderful.
Yes, Tom, we really appreciate you spending the time with us this morning.
All right.
Again, thank you for the invitation.
All right. So we'll have this up as a podcast here and pour the days out. And I want to thank you very much. And we will take care of each other. Okay. It's late, but everything comes next.